when it's cold, most of the tales agree. Or else it gets cold when they come. Sometimes they appear during snowstorms and melt away when the sky's clear. They hide from the light of the sun and emerge by night. Or else night falls when they emerge. Some stories speak of them riding the corpses of dead animals, bears, direwolves, mammoths, horses. It makes no matter, so long as the beast is dead. The one that killed Small Paul was riding a dead horse. So that part's plainly true. Some accounts speak of giant ice spiders, too. I don't know what those are. Men who fall in battle against the others must be burned, or else the dead will rise again as their thralls. We knew all this. The question is, how do we fight them? The armor of the others is proof against most ordinary blades. If the tale can be believed, said Sam, and their own swords are so cold they shatter steel. Fire will dismay them, though, and they are vulnerable to obsidian. He remembered the one he had faced in the haunted forest, and how it had seemed to melt away when he stabbed it with the dragonglass dagger John had made for him. I found one account of the Long Night that spoke of the last hero slaying others with a blade of dragonsteel. Supposedly, they could not stand against it.
Dragonsteel? John frowned.
Valyrian steel? That was my first thought as well.
So, if I can just convince the lords of the Seven Kingdoms to give us their Valyrian blades, all is saved. That won't be hard. His laugh had no mirth in it. Did you find who the others are? Where they come from? What they want?
Not yet, my lord, but it may be that I've just been reading the wrong books. There are hundreds I have not looked at yet. Give me more time, and I will find whatever there is to be found.
There is no more time, John sounded sad. You need to get your things together, Sam. You're going with Jilly.
Going? For a moment Sam did not understand. I'm going to Eastwatch, my lord, or where am I?
Old Town.
Old Town! It came out in a squeak.
Hornhill was close to Old Town.
Home! The notion made him light-headed. My father!
Aemon as well.
Aemon? Mr. Aemon, but he's 102 years old, my lord. He can't... You send him and me? Who will tend the ravens, if they're sick or wounded? Who?
Clydes. He's been with Aemon for years.
Clydes is only a steward, and his eyes are going bad. You need a maester. Maester Aemon is so frail. A sea voyage.
He thought of the arbor and the arbor queen, and almost choked on his tongue.
It might... He's old, and...
His life will be at risk, I'm aware of that, Sam. But the risk is greater here. Stannis knows who Aemon is. If the Red Woman requires King's blood for her spells...
Oh!
Sam paled. Darion will join you at Eastwatch. My hope is that his songs will win some men for us in the south. The Blackbird will deliver you to Braavos. From there, you'll arrange your own passage to Old Town. If you still mean to claim Jilly's babe as your bastard, send her and the child unto Horn Hill. Elsewise, Aemon will find a servant's place for her at the Citadel.
My bastard!
He had said that, yes, but
all that water, I could drown. Ships sink all the time, and autumn is a stormy season.
Jilly would be with him, though, and the babe would grow up safe.
Yes, my mother and my sisters will help Jilly with the child. I can send a letter.
I won't need to go to Hornhill myself. Darien could see her to Old Town just as well as me. I've been working at my archery every afternoon with Ulmer, as you commanded. Well, except when I'm in the vaults. But you told me to find out about the others. The longbow makes my shoulders ache and raises blisters on my fingers. He showed John where one had burst. I still do it, though. I can hit the target more often than not now, but I'm still the worst archer who ever bent a bow. I like Ulmer's stories, though. Someone needs to write them down and put them in a book. You do it. They have parchment and ink at the Citadel, as well as longbows. I will expect you to continue with your practice. Sam,
the Night's Watch has hundreds of men who can loose an arrow, but only a handful who can read or write. I need you to become my new maester. The word made him flinch.
No, father, please, I won't speak of it again. I swear it by the Seven. Let me out, please, let me out. My lord, my work is here, the books.
We'll be here when you return to us. Sam put a hand to his throat. He could almost feel the chain there, choking him.
My lord, the Citadel, they make ye cut up corpses there. They make you wear a chain about your neck. If it is change you want, come with me.
For 3 days and three nights, Sam had subbed himself to sleep, manacled hand and foot to a wall. The chain around his throat was so tight it broke the skin, and whenever he rolled the wrong way in his sleep, it would cut off his breath.
I cannot wear a chain.
You can, you will. Maester Aemon is old and blind, his strength is leaving him. Who will take his place when he dies? Maester Mullen at the Shadow Tower is more fighter than scholar. Maester Hamoon of Eastwatch is drunk more than is sober.
If you ask the Citadel for more maesters,
I mean to. We'll have need of everyone. Aemon Targaryen is not so easily replaced, however. John seemed puzzled. I was certain this would please you. There were so many books at the Citadel that no man can hope to read them all. You would do well there, Sam. I know you would.
No, I could read the books, but a maester must be a healer, and blood makes me faint.
He held out a shaky hand for John to see.
I'm Sam the Scared, not Sam the Slayer.
Scared? Of what? The chidings of old men. Sam, you saw the whites come swarming up the fist, a tide of living dead men with black hands and bright blue eyes. You slew an other.
It was a dragon glass, not me.
Be quiet. You lied and schemed and plotted to make me Lord Commander. You will obey me. You'll go to the Citadel and forge a chain. And if you have to cut up corpses, so be it. At least in Old Town, the corpses won't object.
He doesn't understand. My lord, Sam said, my father, Lord Randall, the life of a maester is a life of servitude. He was babbling, he knew. No son of House Tarly will ever wear a chain. The men of Hornhill do not bow and scrape to petty lords. If this chain you want, come with me. John, I cannot disobey my father.
John, he'd said. But John was gone. It was Lord Snow who faced him now, grey eyes as hard as ice. You have no father, said Lord Snow. Only brothers. Only us. Your life belongs to the Night's Watch. So go and stuff your small clothes into a sack, along with anything else you care to take to Old Town. You leave an hour before sunrise. And here's another order. From this day forth, you will not call yourself a craven. You faced more things this past year than most men face in a lifetime. You can face the Citadel, but you'll face it as a sworn brother of the Night's Watch. I can't
command you to be brave, but I can command you to hide your fears. You said the word, Sam. Remember,
I am the sword in the darkness.
But he was wretched with the sword, and the darkness scared him.
I'll try.
You won't try, you will obey.
Obey!
Borman's raven flapped its great black wings.
As my lord commands, does Mr. Aemon know?
It was as much his idea as mine. John opened the door for him. No farewells. The fewer folk who know of this, the better. An hour before first light, by the lich yard. Sam did not recall leaving the armory. The next thing he knew, he was stumbling through mud and patches of old snow toward Maester Aemon's chambers.
I could hide, he told himself. I could hide in the vaults among the books. I could live down there with the mouse and sneak up at night to steal food.
Crazed thoughts, he knew, as futile as they were desperate. The vaults were the first place they would look for him. The last place they would look for him was beyond the wall. But that was even madder.
The wildlings would catch me and kill me slowly. They might burn me alive, the way the Red Woman means to burn Mance Rayder.
When he found Maester Aemon in the rookery, he gave him John's letter and blurted out his fears in a great green gush of words.
He does not understand.
Sam felt as though he might throw up.
If I don a chain, my lord father, my own father raised the same objection when I chose a life of service,
the old man said.
It was his father who sent me to the citadel. King Darren had sired four sons, and three had sons of their own. Too many dragons are as dangerous as too few, I heard his grace tell my lord father the day they sent me off.
Aemon raised a spotted hand to the chain of many metals that dangled loose about his thin neck.
The chain is heavy, Sam, but my grandsire had the right of it. So does your Lord Snow.
Snow!
A raven muttered.
Snow!
Another echoed. All of them picked it up then.
Snow! 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 Snow!
Sam had taught them that word. There was no help here, he saw. Maester Aemon was as trapped as he was.
He will die at sea, he thought, despairing. He is too old to survive such a voyage. Gilly's little son may die as well. He's not as large and strong as Dalla's boy. Does John mean to kill us all?
The next morning, Sam found himself saddling the mare he'd ridden from Horn Hill, and leading her toward the lich yard beside the eastern road. Her saddlebags bulged with cheese and sausages and hard-cooked eggs, and half-assorted ham that Three-Finger Hob had given him on his name day.
"You're a man who appreciates cooking, Slayer,"
the cook had said.
"We need more of your sort."
The ham would help, no doubt. Eastwatch was a long, cold ride away, and there were no towns nor inns in the shadow of the wall. The hour before dawn was dark and still. Castle Black seemed strangely hushed. At the lich yard a pair of two-wheeled wains awaited him, along with Black Jack Bulwer and a dozen seasoned rangers, tough as the garrons they rode. Kedge Whiteye cursed loudly when his one good eye spied Sam.
"Don't mind him, Slayer," said Black Jack. "He lost a wager. Said we'd need to drag you out squealing from beneath some bed."
Master Aemon was too frail to ride a horse, so a wain had been made ready for him, its bed heaped high with furs and a leather awning fastened overhead to keep off the rain and snow. Gilly and her child would ride with him. The second wain would carry their clothing and possessions. along with a chest of rare old books that Eamon thought the Citadel might lack. Sam had spent half the night searching for them, though he'd found only one in four.
And a good thing, or we'd need another wain.
When the maester appeared, he was bundled up in a bearskin three times his size. As Clydes led him toward the wain, a gust of wind came up, and the old man staggered. Sam hurried to his side and put an arm about him.
"Another gust like that could blow him over the wall." "Keep hold of my arm, maester. It's not far."
The blind man nodded as the wind pushed back their hoods.
"It is always warm in Old Town. There is an inn on an island in the Honey Wine where I used to go when I was a young novice. It will be pleasant to sit there once again, sipping cider."
By the time they got the maester into the wain, Jilly had appeared, the child bundled in her arms. Beneath her hood, her eyes were red from crying. John turned up at the same time, with Dolorous Ed.
"Lord Snow," Maester Eamon called, "I left a book for you in my chambers, The Jade Compendium. It was written by the Volantine adventurer, Coloquo Votar, who travelled to the east and visited all the lands of the Jade Sea. There is a passage you might find of interest. I've told Clydes to mark it for you."
"I'll be sure to read it," John Snow replied. A line of pale snot ran from Maester Eamon's nose. He wiped it away with the back of his glove.
"Knowledge is a weapon, John. Arm yourself well before you ride forth to battle."
"I will." A light snow had begun to fall, the big soft flakes drifting down lazily from the sky. John turned to Black Jack Bulwer. "Make as good a time as you can, but take no foolish risks. You have an old man and a suckling babe with you. See that you keep them warm and well-fed."
"You do the same, my lord," said Jilly. "You do the same for t'other. Find another wet nurse, like you said. You promised me you would. The boy, Dallas boy, the little prince, I mean, you find him some good woman, so he grows up big and strong."
"You have my word," John Snow said solemnly.
"Don't you name him. Don't you do that till he's past 2 years. It's ill luck to name them when they're still on the breast. You crows may not know that, but it's true."
"As you command, my lady." A spasm of anger flashed across Jilly's face.
"Don't you call me that. I'm a mother, not a lady. I'm Christ's wife, and Christ's daughter, and a mother."
Dolorous Ed took the babe as Jilly climbed into the wain and covered her legs with some musty pelts. By then the eastern sky was more grey than black. Left-hand Lou was anxious to be off. Ed handed the infant up, and Jilly put him to her breast.
"This may be the last I shall ever see of Castle Black," thought Sam, as he hoisted himself atop his mare.
As much as he had once hated Castle Black, it was tearing him apart to leave it.
"Let's do this,"
Bulwer commanded. A whip snapped, and the wains began to rumble slowly down the rutted road as the snow came down around them. Sam lingered beside Clydes and Dolorous Ed and John Snow.
"Well," he said, "farewell."
"Under you, Sam," said Dolorous Ed. "Your boat's not like to sink, I don't think. Boats only sink when I'm aboard."
John was watching the wains. "The first time I saw Jilly," he said, "she was pressed back against the wall of Craister's Keep, this skinny, dark-haired girl with her big belly cringing away from Ghost. He had gotten in among her rabbits, and I think she was frightened that he would tear her open and devour the babe. But it was not the wolf she should have been afraid of, was it?"
"No," Sam thought. "Craister was the danger, her own father. She has more courage than she knows.
So do you, Sam. Have a swift, safe voyage, and take care of her and Eamon and the child.
John smiled a strange, sad smile.
And pull your hood up. The snowflakes are melting in your hair.
Aria. Faint and far away, the light burned, low on the horizon, shining through the sea mists.
"It looks like a star," said Aria.
"The star of home," said Denyo.
His father was shouting orders. Sailors scrambled up and down the three tall masts and moved along the rigging, reefing the heavy purple sails. Below, oarsmen heaved and strained over two great banks of oars. The decks tilted, creaking, as the galleass, Titan's daughter, heeled to starboard and began to come about.
"The star of home."
Arya stood at the prow, one hand resting on the gilded figurehead, a maiden with a bowl of fruit. For half a heartbeat, she let herself pretend that it was her home ahead. But that was stupid. Her home was gone. Her parents dead, and all her brothers slain, but Jon Snow on the wall. That was where she had wanted to go. She told the captain as much, but even the iron coin did not sway him. Arya never seemed to find places she set out to reach. Yoren had sworn to deliver her to Winterfell, only she had ended up in Harrenhal, and Yoren in his grave. When she escaped Harrenhal for Riverrun, Lem and Angai and Tamos Sevens took her captive and dragged her to the Hollow Hill instead. Then the Hound had stolen her and dragged her to the Twins. Arya had left him dying by the river and gone ahead to Saltpans, hoping to take passage for Eastwatch by the sea. Only,
"A Braavos might not be so bad. Sirio was from Braavos, and Jaqen might be there as well. It was Jaqen who had given her the iron coin. He hadn't truly been her friend, the way that Sirio had. But what good had friends ever done her? I don't need any friends, so long as I have Needle."
She brushed the ball of her thumb across the sword's smooth pommel. Wishing, wishing. If truth be told, Arya did not know what to wish for, any more than she knew what awaited her beneath that distant light. The captain had given her passage, but he had no time to speak with her. Some of the crew shunned her, but others gave her gifts. A silver fork, fingerless gloves, a floppy woolen hat patched with leather. One man showed her how to tie sailor's knots. Another poured her thimble cups of fire wine. The friendly ones would tap their chests, repeating their names over and over until Arya said them back, though none ever thought to ask her name. They called her Salty, since she'd come aboard at Saltpans, near the mouth of the Trident. It was as good a name as any, she supposed. The last of the night stars had vanished, all but the pair dead ahead.
"It's two stars now."
"Two eyes," said Denyo. "The Titan sees us."
The Titan of Braavos. Old Nan had told them stories of the Titan back in Winterfell. He was a giant as tall as a mountain, and whenever Braavos stood in danger, he would wake with fire in his eyes, his rocky limbs grinding and groaning as he waded out into the sea to smash the enemies.
The Braavosi feed him on the juicy pink flesh of little high-born girls,
Nan would end, and Sansa would give a stupid squeak. But Maester Luwin said the Titan was only a statue, and old Nan's stories were only stories.
"Winterfell is burned and fallen,"
Arya reminded herself. Old Nan and Maester Luwin were both dead, most like, and Sansa too. It did no good to think of them.
"Our men must die."
That was what the words meant. The words that Jaqen Hagar had taught her when he gave her the worn iron coin. She had learned more of Braavosi words
since they left Saltpans. The words for please, and thank you, and sea, and star, and fire wine. But she came to them knowing that all men must die. Most of the daughter's crew had a smattering of the common tongue, from knights ashore in Old Town and King's Landing and Maidenpool, though only the captain and his son spoke it well enough to talk to her. Denio was the youngest of those sons, a plump, cheerful boy of 12 who kept his father's cabin and helped his eldest brother do his sums.
"I hope your Titan isn't hungry,"
Arya told him. "Hungry?" Denio said, confused.
"It takes no matter. Even if the Titan did eat juicy pink girl flesh, Arya would not fear him.
She was a scrawny thing, no proper meal for a giant, and almost 11, practically a woman grown."
"And Sorti isn't highborn either. Is the Titan the god of Braavos?" she asked. "Or do you have the 7?
"All gods are honored in Braavos."
The captain's son loved to talk about his city almost as much as he loved to talk about his father's ship.
"Your 7 have a sept here, the sept beyond the sea, but only Westerosi sailors worship there."
"And they're not my 7. They were my mother's gods, and they let the Freys murder her at the Twins."
She wondered whether she would find a godswood in Braavos, with a weirwood at its heart. Denio might know, but she could not ask him. Salty was from Saltpans, and what would a girl from Saltpans know about the old gods of the north?
"The old gods are dead," she told herself, "with mother and father and Rob and Bran and Rickon, all dead."
A long time ago she remembered her father saying that when the cold winds blow, the lone wolf dies and the pack survives.
He had it all backwards.
Arya, the lone wolf, still lived, but the wolves of the pack had been taken and slain and skinned.
"The moon singers led us to this place of refuge, where the dragons of Valyria could not find us," Denio said. "Theirs is the greatest temple. We esteem the Father of Waters as well, but his house is built anew whenever he takes his bride. The rest of the gods dwell together on an isle in the center of the city. That is where you will find the many-faced god."
The Titan's eyes seemed brighter now, and farther apart. Arya did not know any many-faced god, but if he answered prayers, he might be the god she sought. Sir Gregor, she thought. Dunson. Rafe the Sweetling. Sir Ilion. Sir Merin. Queen Cersei. Only 6 now. Joffrey was dead. The Hound had slain Polybar, and she'd stabbed the Tickler herself, and that stupid squire with a pimple.
"Hey, I would have killed him if he hadn't grabbed me."
The Hound had been dying when she left him on the banks of the Triton, burning up with fever from his wound.
"I should have given him the gift of mercy and put a knife into his heart." "Salty, look!"
Denio took her by the arm and turned her.
"Can you see there?" he pointed.
The mist gave way before them, ragged grey curtains parted by their prow. The Titan's daughter cleaved through the grey-green waters on billowing purple wings. Arya could hear the cries of seabirds overhead. There, where Denio pointed, a line of stony ridges rose sudden from the sea, their steep slopes covered with soldier pines and black spruce. But dead ahead, the sea had broken through, and there, above the open water, the Titan towered, with his eyes blazing and his long green hair blowing in the wind. His legs bestrode the gap, 1 foot planted on each mountain, his shoulders looming tall above the jagged crests. His legs were carved of solid stone, the same black granite as the sea months on which he stood, though round his hips he wore an armoured skirt of greenish bronze. His breastplate was bronze as well, and his head in his crested half-helm. His blowing hair was made of hempen ropes dyed green, and huge fires burned in the caves that were his eyes. 1 hand rested atop the ridge to his left,
bronze fingers coiled around a knob of stone, the other thrust up into the air, clasping the hilt of a broken sword.
"He's only a little bigger than King Balor's statue in King's Landing," she told herself,
when they were still well off to sea. As the galleys drove closer to where the breakers smashed against the ridgeline, however, the Titan grew larger still. She could hear Denyo's father bellowing commands in his deep voice, and up in the rigging men were bringing in the sails.
"We're going to row beneath the Titan's legs."
Arya could see the arrow slits in the great bronze breastplate, and stains and speckles on the Titan's arms and shoulders where seabirds nested. Her neck craned upward.
"Balor the Blessed would not reach his knee. He could step right over the walls of Winterfell."
Then the Titan gave a mighty roar. The sound was as huge as he was, a terrible groaning and grinding so loud it drowned out even the captain's voice and the crash of the waves against those pine-clad ridges. 1,000 seabirds took to the air at once, and Arya flinched until she saw that Denyo was laughing.
"He warns the arsenal of our coming, that is all," he shouted. "You must not be afraid." "I never was," Arya shouted back. "It was loud, is all."
Wind and wave had the Titan's daughter hard in hand now, driving her swiftly towards the channel. Her double bank of oars stroked smoothly, lashing the sea to white foam as the Titan shadow fell upon them. For a moment it seemed as though they must surely smash up against the stones beneath his legs. Huddled by Denyo at the prow, Arya could taste salt where the spray had touched her face. She had to look straight up to see the Titan's head.
"The brava sea feed him on the juicy pink flesh of little high-born girls,"
she heard old Nan say again. But she was not a little girl, and she would not be frightened of a stupid statue. Even so, she kept one hand on Needle as they slipped between his legs. More arrow slits dotted the inside of those great stone thighs, and when Arya craned her neck around to watch the crow's nest slip through, with a good 10 yards to spare, she spied murder holes beneath the Titan's armored skirts, and pale faces staring down at them from behind the iron bars. And then they were past. The shadow lifted. The pine-clad ridges fell away to either side. The winds dwindled, and they found themselves moving through a great lagoon. Ahead rose another seamount, a knob of rock that pushed up from the water like a spiked fist, its stony battlements bristling with scorpions, spitfires, and trebuchets.
"The Arsenal of Braavos,"
Denyo named it, as proudly as if he'd built it.
"They can build a war galley there in a day."
Arya could see dozens of galleys tied up at quays and perched on launching slips. The painted prows of others poked from innumerable wooden sheds along the stony shores, like hounds in a kennel, lean and mean and hungry, waiting for a hunter's horn to call them forth. She tried to count them, but there were too many, and more docks and sheds and quays where the shoreline curved away. 2 galleys had come out to meet them. They seemed to skim upon the water like dragonflies, their pale oars flashing. Arya heard the captain shouting to them, and their own captains shouting back. But she did not understand the words. A great horn sounded. The galleys passed to either side of them, so close that she could hear the muffled sound of drums from within their purple hulls. Boom-boom, 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 like the beat of living hearts. Then the galleys were behind them, and the arsenal as well. Ahead stretched a broad expanse of pea-green water, rippled like a sheet of coloured glass. From its wet heart arose the city proper, a great sprawl of domes and towers and bridges, grey and gold and red.
"The 100 Isles of Braavos in the sea."
Maester Lewin had taught them about Braavos, but Arya had forgotten much of what he'd said. It was a flat city, she could see that even from afar, not like King's Landing on its three high hills. The only hills here were the ones that men had raised, of brick and granite, bronze and marble. Something else was missing as well, though it took her a few moments to realize what it was.
And a city has no walls.
But when she said as much to Denyo, he laughed at her.
Our walls are made of wood and painted purple, he told her. Our galleys are our walls. We need no other.
The deck creaked behind them. Arya turned to find Denyo's father looming over them in his long captain's coat of purple wool. Tradesman Captain Tenesio Terris wore no whiskers and kept his grey hair cut short and neat, framing his square, wind-burnt face. On the crossing, she had often seen him jesting with his crew, but when he frowned, men ran from him, as if before a storm. He was frowning now.
"Our voyage is at an end," he told Arya. "We make for the Chakoi port, where the Sea Lord's custom officers will come aboard to inspect our holds. There will be half a day at it. They always are. But there is no need for you to wait upon their pleasure. Gather your belongings. I shall lower a boat, and your crew will put you ashore."
"Ashore?"
Arya bit her lip. She had crossed the narrow sea to get here, but if the captain had asked, she would have told him she wanted to stay aboard the Titan's daughter. Salty was too small to man an oar. She knew that now, but she could learn to splice ropes and reef the sails and steer a course across the great salt seas. Denya had taken her up to the crow's nest once, and she hadn't been afraid at all, though the deck had seemed a tiny thing below her.
"I can do sums, too, and keep a cabin neat."
But the galleys had no need of a second boy. Besides, she had only to look at the captain's face to know how anxious he was to be rid of her. So Arya only nodded.
"Ashore," she said,
though ashore meant only strangers.
"Valar Doharis," he touched two fingers to his brow. "I beg you remember Tenesio Terris and the service he has done you."
"I will,"
Arya said in a small voice. The wind tugged at her cloak, insistent as a ghost. It was time she was away.
"Gather your belongings," the captain had said,
but there were few enough of those. Only the clothes she was wearing, the little pouch of coins, the gifts the crew had given her, the dagger on her left hip, and needle on her right. The boat was ready before she was, and Yorko was at the oars. He was the captain's son as well, but older than Denyo and less friendly.
"I never said farewell to Denyo," she thought, as she clambered down to join him.
She wondered if she would ever see the boy again.
"I should have said farewell."
The Titan's daughter dwindled in their wake, while the city grew larger with every stroke of Yorko's oars. A harbour was visible, off to the right, a tangle of piers and quays crowded with big-belly whalers out of Ibn. Swan ships from the Summer Isles, and more galleys than a girl could count. Another harbour, more distant, was off to her left, beyond a sinking point of land, where the tops of half-drowned buildings thrust themselves above the water. Arya had never seen so many big buildings all together in one place. King's Landing had the Red Keep and the Great Sept of Baelor and the Dragon Pit, but Brava seemed to boast a score of temples and towers and palaces that were as large or even larger.
"I will be a mouse again," she thought glumly, "the way I was in Harrenhal before I ran away."
The city had seemed like one big island from where the Titan stood. But as Yorko rode them closer, she saw that it was many small islands close together, linked by arched stone bridges that spanned innumerable canals. Beyond the harbour she glimpsed streets of grey stone houses built so close they leaned one upon the other. To Arya's eyes they were queer-looking, 4 and 5 stories tall and very skinny, with sharp peat-tiled roofs, like pointed hats. she saw no thatch, and only a few timbered houses of the sort she knew in Westeros.
"They have no trees," she realized. "Braavos is all stone, a grey city in a green sea."
Yorko swung them north of the docks and down the gullet of a great canal, a broad green waterway that ran straight into the heart of the city. They passed onto the arches of a carved stone bridge, decorated with 50 kinds of fish and crabs and squids. A second bridge appeared ahead, this one carved in lacy, leafy vines, and beyond that a third, gazing down on them from 1,000 painted eyes. The mouths of lesser canals opened to either side, and others still smaller, off of those. Some of the houses were built above the waterways, she saw, turning the canals into a sort of tunnel. Slender boats slid in and out among them, wrought in the shapes of water serpents, with painted heads and upraised tails. They were not rowed, but poled, she saw, by men who stood at their sterns in cloaks of grey and brown and deep musk-green. She saw huge flat-bottomed barges, too, heaped high with crates and barrels and pushed along by 20 polemen to a side, and fancy floating houses with lanterns of coloured glass, velvet drapes, and brazen figureheads. Off in the far distance, looming above canals and houses both, was a massive grey stone roadway of some kind, supported by 3 tiers of mighty arches marching away south into the haze.
"What's that?"
Arya asked Yorko, pointing.
"The Sweetwater River," he told her.
"It brings fresh water from the mainland across the mud flats and the briny shallows. Good sweet water for the fountains." When she looked behind her, the harbour and lagoon were lost to sight. Ahead, a row of mighty statues stood along both sides of the channel, solemn stone men in long bronze robes, spattered with the droppings of the seabirds. Some held books, some daggers, some hammers. One clutched a golden star in his upraised hand. Another was upending a stone flagon to send an endless stream of water splashing down into the canal.
"Are they gods?" asked Arya.
"Sea lords," said Yorko. "The Isle of the Gods is further on. See? 6 bridges down on the right bank. That is the Temple of the Moonsingers." It was one of those that Arya had spied from the lagoon, a mighty mass of snow-white marble topped by a huge silver dome whose milk-glass windows showed all the phases of the moon. A pair of marble maidens flanked its gates, tall as a sea lord's, supporting a crescent-shaped lintel. Beyond it stood another temple, a red stone edifice as stern as any fortress. Atop its great square tower, a fire blazed in an iron brazier 20 feet across, while smaller fires flanked its brazen doors. "The Red Priests love their fires," Yorko told her. "The Lord of Light is their god, Red R'hllor."
"I know,"
Arya remembered. Thoris of Myr, in his bits of old armour, worn over robe so faded that he had seemed more a pink priest than a red one. Yet his kiss had brought Lord Beric back from death. She watched the Red Guard's house drift by, wondering whether those Braavosi priests of hers could do the same. Next came a huge brick structure festooned with lichen. Arya might have taken it for a storehouse, had not Yorko said, "That is the holy refuge where we honour the small gods the world has forgotten. You will hear it called the Warren, too." A small canal ran between the Warren's looming lichen-covered walls, and there he swung them right. They passed through a tunnel and out again into the light. More shrines loomed up on either side.
I never knew there were so many gods," Arya said.
Yorko grunted. They went around a bend and beneath another bridge. On their left appeared a rocky knoll, with a windowless temple of dark grey stone at its top. A flight of stone steps led from its doors down to a covered dock. Yoko backed the oars, and the boat bumped gently against stone pilings. He grasped an iron ring, set to hold them for a moment.
"Here I leave you." The dock was shadowed, the steps steep. The temple's black tile roof came to a sharp peak, like the houses along the canals.
Arya chewed her lip.
"Asirio came from Braavos. He might have visited this temple. He might have climbed those steps."
She grabbed a ring and pulled herself up onto the dock. "You know my name?" said Yorko from the boat.
"Yorko Terrace."
"Valar Dohaeris." He pushed off with his oar and drifted back off into the deeper water. Arya watched him row back the way they'd come until he vanished in the shadow of the bridge. As the swish of oars faded, she could almost hear the beating of her heart. Suddenly, she was somewhere else, back in Harrenhal, with Gendry, maybe, or with the Hound in the woods along the Trident.
"Isolde is a stupid child," she told herself. "I am a wolf, and will not be afraid."
She patted Needle's hilt for luck, and plunged into the shadows, taking the steps two at a time, so no one could ever say she'd been afraid. At the top she found a set of carved wooden doors, 12 feet high. The left-hand door was made of weirwood, pale as bone, the right of gleaming ebony. In their centre was a carved moon face, ebony on the weirwood side, weirwood on the ebony. The look of it reminded her somehow of the heart tree in the Godswood at Winterfell.
"The doors are watching me," she thought.
She pushed upon both doors at once with the flat of her gloved hands, but neither one would budge.
"Locked and barred." "Let me in, you stupid," she said. "I cross the narrow sea."
She made a fist and pounded.
"Jacob told me to come. I have the iron coin."
She pulled it from her pouch and held it up.
"See? Velar Morghulis."
The doors made no reply, except to open. They opened inward, all in silence, with no human hand to move them. Arya took a step forward, and another. The doors closed behind her, and for a moment she was blind. Needle was in her hand, though she did not remember drawing it. A few candles burned along the walls, but gave so little light that Arya could not see her own feet. Someone was whispering, too softly for her to make out words. Someone else was weeping. She heard light footfalls, leather sliding over stone, a door opening and closing.
"Water. I hear water, too."
Slowly her eyes adjusted. The temple seemed much larger within than it had without. The septs of Westeros were seven-sided, with seven altars for the seven gods. But here there were more gods than seven. Statues of them stood along the walls, massive and threatening. Around their feet red candles flickered, as dim as distant stars. The nearest was a marble woman 12 feet tall. Real tears were trickling from her eyes, to fill the bowl she cradled in her arms. Beyond her was a man with a lion's head, seated on a throne carved of ebony. On the other side of the doors a huge horse of bronze and iron reared up on two great legs. Farther on she could make out a great stone face, a pale infant with a sword, a shaggy black goat the size of an oryx, a hooded man leaning on a staff. The rest were only looming shapes to her, half seen through the gloom. Between the gods were hidden alcoves thick with shadows, with here and there a candle burning. Silent as a shadow, Arya moved between rows of long stone benches, her sword in hand. The floor was made of stone, her feet told her. Not polished marble like the floor of the great sept of Baelor, but something rougher. She passed some women whispering together. The air was warm and heavy, so heavy that she yawned. She could smell the candles. The scent was unfamiliar, and she put it down to some queer incense. But as she got deeper into the temple, They seemed to smell of snow and pine needles and hot stew.
A good smells,
Arya told herself, and felt a little braver. Brave enough to slip needle back into its sheath. In the centre of the temple she found the water she had heard, a pool 10 feet across, black as ink, and lit by dim red candles. Beside it sat a young man in a silvery cloak, weeping softly. She watched him dip a hand in the water, sending scarlet ripples racing across the pool. When he drew his fingers back, he sucked them, one by one.
He must be thirsty.
There were stone cups all along the rim of the pool. Arya filled one and brought it to him, so he could drink. The young man stared at her for a moment when she offered it to him.
"Velar Morghulis,"
he said.
"Velar Dohaeris," she replied.
He drank deep and dropped the cup into the pool with a soft plop. Then he pushed himself to his feet, swaying, holding his belly. For a moment Arya thought he was going to fall. It was only then that she saw the dark stain beneath his belt, spreading as she watched.
"You're stabbed,"
she blurted, but the man paid her no mind. He lurched unsteadily toward the wall and crawled into an alcove onto a hard stone bed. When Arya peered around, she saw other alcoves too. On some, there were old people sleeping.
"No,"
a half-remembered voice seemed to whisper in her head.
"They are dead, or dying. Look with your eyes."
A hand touched her arm. Arya spun away. But it was only a little girl, a pale little girl, in a cowled robe that seemed to engulf her, black on the right side and white on the left. Beneath the cowl was a gaunt and bony face, hollow cheeks and dark eyes that looked as big as saucers.
"Don't grab me,"
Arya warned the waif.
"I killed the boy who grabbed me last."
The girl said some words that Arya did not know. She shook her head.
"Don't you know the common tongue?"
The voice behind her said, "I do." Arya did not like the way they kept surprising her. The hooded man was tall, enveloped in a larger version of the black-and-white robe the girl was wearing. Beneath his cowl, all she could see was the faint red glitter of candlelight reflecting off his eyes.
"What place is this?"
she asked him.
"Place of peace,"
his voice was gentle.
"You are safe here. This is the house of black and white, my child. Though you are young to seek the favour of the many-faced god."
"Is he like the southern god, the one with 7 faces?
"7? No. He has faces beyond count, little one, as many faces as there are stars in the sky. In Braavos, men worship as they will, but at the end of every road stands him of many faces, waiting. He will be there for you one day. Do not fear. You need not rush to his embrace. I only came to find Jaqen H'ghar. I do not know this name."
Her heart sank.
"He was from Loras. His hair was white on one side and red on the other. He said he'd teach me secrets, and gave me this."
The iron coin was clutched in her fist. When she opened her fingers, it clung to her sweaty palm. The priest studied the coin, though he made no move to touch it. The waif with the big eyes was looking at it too. Finally the cowled man said,
"Tell me your name, child."
"Salty. I come from Salt Pans, by the Trident."
Though she could not see his face, somehow she could feel him smiling.
"No," he said. "Tell me your name."
"Squab,"
she answered this time.
"Your true name, child?" "My mother called me Nan, but they call me Weasel."
"Your name?"
She swallowed.
"Ari. I'm Ari."
"Closer. And now the truth?"
Fear cuts deeper than swords, she told herself. Harrier, she whispered the word the first time. The second time, she threw it at him. I am Harrier of House Stark. You are, he said. But the House of Black and White is no place for Arya of House Stark. Please, she said, I have no place to go. Do you fear death? She bit her lip. No. Let us see. The priest lowered his cowl. Beneath, he had no face. Only a yellowed skull, with a few scraps of skin still clinging to the cheeks, and a white worm wriggling from one empty eye socket. Kiss me, child, he croaked, in a voice as dry and husky as a death rattle. Does he think to scare me? Arya kissed him where his nose should be, and plucked the grey worm from his eye to eat it. But it melted like a shadow in her hand. The yellow skull was melting too, and the kindliest old man that she had ever seen was smiling down at her. No one has ever tried to eat my worm before, he said. Are you hungry, child? Yes, she thought, but not for food.
Cersei. A cold rain was falling, turning the walls and ramparts of the Red Keep dark as blood. The queen held the king's hand and led him firmly across the muddy yard to where her litter waited with its escort.
Uncle Jamie said I could ride my horse and throw pennies to the small folk,
the boy objected. Do you want to catch a chill? She would not risk it. Tommen had never been as robust as Joffrey.
Your grandfather would want you to look a proper king at his wake. We will not appear at the great sept wet and bedraggled. Bad enough, I must wear mourning again.
Black had never been a happy colour on her. With her fair skin, it made her look half a corpse herself. Cersei had risen an hour before dawn to bathe and fix her hair, and she did not intend to let the rain destroy her efforts. Inside the litter, Tommen settled back against his pillows and peered out at the falling rain.
The gods are weeping for Grandfather. Lady Jocelyn says the raindrops are their tears.
Jocelyn Swift is a fool. If the gods could weep, they would have wept for your brother. Rain is rain. Close the curtain before you let any more in. The mantle is sable. Would you have it soaked? Tommen did as he was bid. His meekness troubled her. A king had to be strong. Joffrey would have argued. He was never easier to cow.
Don't slump so, she told Tommen. Sit like a king. Put your shoulders back and straighten your crown. You want it to tumble off your head in front of all your lords? No, mother.
The boy sat straight and reached up to fix the crown. Joff's crown was too big for him. Tommen had always inclined to plumpness, but his face seemed thinner now.
Is he eating well?
She must remember to ask the steward. She could not risk Tommen growing ill, not with Marcella in the hands of the Dornishman.
He will grow into Joff's crown in time.
Until he did, a smaller one might be needed, one that did not threaten to swallow his head. She would take it up with the goldsmiths. The litter made its slow way down Aegon's high hill. Two Kingsguard rode before them, white knights on white horses with white cloaks hanging sudden from their shoulders. Behind came 50 Lannister guardsmen in gold and crimson. Tommen peered through the drapes at the empty streets.
I thought there would be more people. When Father died, all the people came out to watch us go by.
This rain has driven them inside. King's Landing had never loved Lord Tywin. He never wanted love, though. You cannot eat love, nor buy a horse with it, nor warm your halls on a cold night, she heard him tell Jamie once, when her brother had been no older than Tommen. At the great sept of Baelor, that magnificence in marble atop Visenya's Hill,
the little knot of mourners were outnumbered by the gold cloaks that Sir Adam Marbrand had drawn up across the plaza. "More will turn out later," the Queen told herself, as Sir Merrin Trant helped her from the litter. Only the highborn and their retinues were to be admitted to the